You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner with EF Education First and Canyon SRAM. Today we are in Croce Daune, Monte Avena.
Big day. I think everyone's been waiting for this day, especially since Gavio was taken out of Mortirolo. It was a bit of a disappointment that, but this is now the big stage before the finish, and I think anything can happen. Vincenzo obviously wants to go all out for the win, everything or nothing. In theory, we've got a couple of plans, which we've sat down with the technical staff and gone through together. Obviously, on the road, you've got to see how the legs are, you know, it all comes down to that. And ultimate goal is obviously to try isolate Carapaz as much as possible, but we've seen they've got a strong team, so it's not going to be easy. But I think we've got to try and make it as exciting as possible for everyone.
That's do you or does he see any weakness in Carapaz in particular?
The only weakness is we don't know how he goes in the heat, and today is going to be quite a hot day. It's been a strange Giro with every day being rained on, besides yesterday was the first day we got through the whole day without getting drops. We'll see today how he reacts to the heat, and maybe we can take advantage of that.
Well, that was Brent Copeland, the general manager at Bahrain Merida, and we, Daniel,
yes.
Freeb,
hello.
That's you. How's your cable tonight? Is it okay?
I don't know. You're in charge of tech.
Uh-huh.
You're in charge of tech.
Sorry about last night's technical problems. I am in charge of tech, and Daniel had a faulty cable last night, but he's sounding great voice
crisp.
Now.
Sounding HD tonight, am I?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Let's hope that lasts. That was Brent Copeland speaking at the start this morning in Feltre.
Yes,
not
yes.
Not bad. And he was discussing the Vincenzo Nibali master plan for today's stage, because all eyes were on Nibali, really, weren't they, today? We expected fireworks from Nibali. What did we get?
Well, we got an attempt to unsettle Primoz Roglic, a successful
bit
attempt.
Of a damp firework.
Well, not in the sense that he gained further time on Roglic. He did everything he could to dislodge Carapaz. Carapaz is intractable, impregnable in the pink jersey. What?
Yeah.
What?
I thought you were gonna.
What's going on? Well, more importantly, Rich,
you've
completely neglected to mention where we are, which is the most important thing about tonight's podcast.
Where are we, Daniel?
Jesus Cristo. We're in the largest brewery in Italy, Pedavina.
It's like a cycling theme park today, isn't it?
It is.
Full of cycling fans. They were showing the cycling in here earlier, and it's a wonderful atmosphere. The sun is shining on the Giro at last.
It's like being in Germany.
It's a bit like being in Germany,
it's like
yeah.
Being back in Berlin.
But today's stage, Daniel, I mean, we heard from Brent Copeland there. It seemed to me that they weren't overly optimistic about Nibali's chances of, as you say, unseating Carapaz. And there was a moment today where the heart sank a bit if you were looking for a really exciting race, because when the crunch came, when Lopez launched his attack, it was Carapaz and Landa who were able to go with him, and Nibali and Roglic both got a little bit distance there.
Nibali really needed to make use of the Passo Mangin, which was the hardest climb on today's route, the second climb of the day, and it just so happened that on the Passo Mangin he had a bit of a rough patch, lost his legs for a moment, and he couldn't really do much there. Alarm bells already sort of rang from my point of view when they only managed to get Damiano Caruso in the break. I wasn't alone in thinking that they needed multiple men down the road, which is what they tried to do earlier in the stage. But with only Caruso down the road, even if Nibali had attacked and been able to bridge, just one rider was always going to be too much to take him to the line and really put Carapaz under serious pressure. But, you know, as I said last night, however you slice and dice it, if the guy in the lead is as strong as Carapaz is, there's very, very little you can do.
Stage 20 then today, 194 kilometres, early start in Feltre, and we were finishing, on the mountain above us where we're standing now, the Croce Daune, which when I had that group set by that name, made by Campagnolo back in the day, and that was the group set that came in just, I think, between Chorus and Record if you're a Campagnolo aficionado.
Many moons ago. It was
the affordable version of the record group set.
And how many shillings did that cost?
In those days,
when you were riding.
In those days, before I knew you, Daniel, yeah. or Rob Hatch, those glorious days of carefree, careless pronunciation, I called it the Crushstone. I think everybody called it that. Well, anyway.
Marvellous.
It was a nice group set. Anyway, today, big day, five climbs, and break went quite early, and we were looking out for, you know, who was going to be in that break from the big teams. Astana had two guys in there. They had Peo Bilbao and Dario Cataldo. Andre Amador was there for Movistar, and Mikel Nievi was there for Michelin Scott, and as you say, Caruso was the only guy there from Bahrain Merida. On the Paso Mangen, which was the big climb up to 2,000 metres, Astana really were the team that took it on there, setting up Lopez for an attack. And as I mentioned already, Landa and Carapaz were the riders who were able to go with him. Nibali and Roglic lost a bit of ground, but they came back very strongly on the descent. And there was a regrouping. There was still a long, long way to go and a lot of valley road before the last few climbs. So that group kind of swelled. The break, you know, kind of broke up, reformed, broke up. Giulio Ciccone was there, very convincing, King of the Mountains. He was one of the men up there who was doing a lot of damage. Nievi was there, Tanel Kangar, Eddie Dunbar from Team Ineos, we'll hear from him a bit later, Madouas from FDJ. They were the main sort of protagonists. Madouas had a go off the front at one point himself. But in the end, it was Carapaz, Landa. Landa looked at one moment that he was going to maybe ride off and win the stage on his own. He looked incredibly strong in that very fluid way that Landa, you know, mouth closed. He looked incredibly smooth. But what his attack did was to really get rid of Roglic once and for all. And Nibali, Landa and Carapaz formed a bit of an alliance, bridging up to the survivors of the breakaway, many of whom managed to stay with them. And in fact, it was one of the survivors of the breakaway, Peo Bilbao, who sprinted in ahead of Mikel Landa to win his second stage of this Giro, salvaging the day for Astana a little bit. It was a bad day for Astana because in the end, Lopez hit a spectator.
Lopez?
Spider-Man hit a spectator and then attacked the spectator. There was some... We didn't get TV footage of the incident, but we were going to hear an eyewitness account of what happened in a moment or two.
Well, and Rich, we're recording the podcast at 7:03 local time is the current time, and we still don't know if Lopez Superman is going to be in the race tomorrow.
Because the rules state quite clearly, if you hit a spectator, yeah, disqualification.
The rule is quite explicit. So this is UCI rule 12.4.001.22.22. Acts of violence towards any other person, so that beside a rider, incurs elimination and a 200 Swiss franc, I think that is, fine.
It will be Swiss francs. He'll be less concerned about that than possible disqualification. The TV cameras didn't capture what actually happened, but Pavel Sivakov was on Lopez's wheel when it happened, so let's hear from him now what happened.
So, maybe it was 500 meters into the climb, and one fan was running on the side, you know, and he just fall in front of Lopez, and Lopez couldn't do anything. He just hit him and crashed. I was just behind. I also had to stop, you know, and no, it was really dodgy situation. I mean, we were all there, and yeah, some guys did just crazy.
That was Sivakov with a bird's eye view of what happened. And
should we hear another account of what happened?
Mm-hmm.
From Jan Hirt, who was the rider, the Astana teammate, who was seen putting Lopez back on his bike after the particular incident.
I don't know. I did not see it exactly.
He took his own bike, or you gave him your bike? No, he took his own.
No, he had his own bike. He had just, I think, chain was fallen. So he just put his chain on and I just pushed him.
Were the spectators getting too close all day, or was it just a normal day out there?
No, I told already many times today. I think cycling is a really nice sport. It's nice that people can be really close to us, but sometimes it's maybe too close, because you see to Vincenzo what happened on the Tour last year also. Today, Miguel is lucky that he didn't break nothing, but sometimes it's too close.
A good Giro for Astana, three stage wins, but a very unlucky one for Miguel Angel, no?
Yeah, that's true. It's it's perfect that we have three stage victories, but Miguel is really unlucky on this Grand Tour, so we have two sides. One is good, one is unlucky.
It's a bit of the Arsene Wenger's there from Jan Hurt. He didn't see it. Is that plausible? Could he not have seen it?
He didn't see Lopez swipe the man's hat from his head, which was the coup de grace.
And yet, 3 seconds later, he was there on the crime scene.
Yeah. I mean, it was... this is a terrible thing to say, but I kind of felt for the spectator a little bit, because he'd gone there for, you know, to enjoy the race and have a nice day out, and ended up on television broadcast around the world being attacked by a 5'5" cyclist in Lycra. Now, albeit a superhero,
yes, yeah.
which is the one consolation for him. But this has been an incident waiting to happen, hasn't it? Really?
Well, it has, especially given that Superman got his nickname for fighting off a couple of kidnappers a few years ago.
A bit more potent back
yeah,
then.
Yeah, but he's famed, venerated for his resistance in the face of acts of violence by assailants, and he proved that today to a certain extent.
But in all seriousness, I don't think any damage was done.
It's a very difficult one for the commissaires, this, because the rules are pretty explicit. There's also the issue of setting a dangerous precedent that they have to consider. We know that spectators get close to the riders. This is something that's not really changed, I don't think, as years have gone by. Some riders will have you believe that it's got worse and that spectators show less respect now than they ever have. I don't necessarily buy that. I think that it's probably gone the other way. But this kind of incident is going to continue to happen. It's happened many times before, and the rider has shown a bit more restraint.
Well, do you remember Chris Froome struck a spectator in the 2016 Tour de France, was it? Just before he attacked over the top of the Super Bannière, was it? In the descent into Luchon, the stage that he won. Was it Super Bannière? Anyway, he definitely struck, he lashed out at a spectator. Then you've got Gianni Moscon hitting a fellow rider last year at the Tour de France and being sent home. So there isn't absolute consistency on this.
No, and the issue of provocation, is it visible provocation? Vladimir Belli was kicked out of the 2001 Giro for something fairly minor. It was a punch, but it was more of, to use rugby parlance, more of a handoff, not really a dangerous gesture, but he was thrown out in 2001. So I'm going to be very intrigued to see how the commissaires deal with this.
Marco Haller the other day on the Giro as well didn't strike the spectator, but certainly used pretty strong
language.
The whistle
had gone then, hadn't it? Does that count?
Oh, that's a good question.
Does that count?
I don't know. We're still waiting to find out whether there are any implications. Sivakov, when I told him there was a possibility of Lopez being thrown off the race, he looked pretty shocked and dismayed by that. He would win the white jersey if that were the case. He doesn't want that to happen.
But it's been a rotten Giro for Superman as far as luck is concerned. We've mentioned the three mechanical issues he had almost, I think they were on consecutive days, weren't they, which cost him without doubt. I was speaking to a couple of directors this morning, and they were saying that he's the best climber in the race at the moment. It was pointless to even try to follow him, or it has been in the last few days, because he's sort of doing these kind of 500 watt attacks which the other riders can simply not match at the moment. Yet his position on GC does not really reflect that, does it? I mean, he's ridden a considerably worse Giro than he did last year, if you go only by GC. Well, I'm not sure that tells the whole story, really.
No, I mean, look, I'll finish the tale of the Tapa. Peo Bilbao was
the tale of the Tapa?
Kind of, was the stage winner. Mikel Landa was second. Ciccone, third. I mean, what a Giro he's had. If you remember, day one, he took the King of the Mountains jersey, didn't he? He's not worn it for one day when it passed on to Brambilla, his teammate, but he's worn it every day since. And he set out on day one to set the fastest time up the climb in Bologna and take the jersey, and he's held it the whole way. We must try and speak to him tomorrow. Carapaz was fourth on the stage. Carapaz, actually, he's been such a comfortable winner that he did a sort of Bradley Wiggins on the Champs-Élysées in 2012 and became a sort of domestique de luxe for Landa, because he was driving that group to really try and distance Roglic and cement Landa's place on the podium. He hasn't quite done that. At the moment, GC is Carapaz first, Nibali at 154. Landa does move up to third at 253. but he's got Roglic breathing down his neck. Roglic got a 10-second penalty. We're going to hear from Adi the Engels a bit later on. He got a 10-second penalty for an extended push. Roglic moves down to fourth. Bauke Mollema remains in fifth. A little bit further down, Zakarin moved up two places to 10th, and so he's top 10. Hugh Carthy moved up two places to 11th. Joe Dombrowski to 12th. And that's all because Davide Formolo had a bad day and moved down to 14th.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner with EF Education First and Canyons RAM.
So I've got the best job in the world because I've got a tailor-made group of friends pretty much wherever I go in the world. And wherever I go for work, it's riding with customers, and the customers are generally club members of the RCC, the Rafa Cycling Club. So I can turn up with my bike, I can meet 20 or 30 people, I'll know they're sort of like-minded, they'll know all the right routes, we'll go off and ride. It's incredible. And lots of people are finding that, you know, you can, they join the club because then when they travel, they can just meet some people and go for a ride and go to see the roads you'd never normally find. So it's the most amazing thing. You see, and you see different parts of the world you wouldn't see, you meet people you wouldn't normally meet. It's fantastic. That's what cycling can do. Being in a club can do that.
And these days, because I cycle so little, unfortunately, because of my day job, I tend to cycle alone. And that also because I'm really bad at cycling these days and unfit. So I tend to be on my own, then I can go at my own pace. I was on a very ordinary bike in Tuscany recently, not a, you know, an ordinary city bike. And I was going left and right up the hill. And one of my pals, who's a pro, came by me and went, "Paul." I went, "Hello." Very quietly, I said, you go. So I prefer to be on my own these days.
Well, that was a further installment of the conversation between Simon Mottram of Rafa and Sir Paul Smith, the famous designer who has come up with a really beautiful design for some Rafa Cycling Club kit. Have a look at that, rafa.cc. It's available now, and it's really nice. It's got that sort of very distinctive Paul Smith look about it, very simple, but with a flash of colour and flair. And that was Paul Smith admitting that his cycling ability isn't perhaps what it used to be. I could listen to Paul Smith all day, actually. He's a great storyteller. Anyway, Daniel, thanks to Rafa. We're here at the Giro and homing in on the final day in Verona tomorrow. But you spoke, I think, to Vincenzo Nibali, and we've spoken a lot about how Nibali would not be happy with the podium. That would be, you know, all or nothing for him today.
Well, he's been in very sanguine form the whole Giro, been very perky indeed, and he was tonight after the stage, having given absolutely everything.
I mean, how many people thought that Carapaz would do a Giro like this? There's still tomorrow, but he's 90% sure to win the race. Today, we needed someone down the road, and my brother was also supposed to go, but I had to stop him because I punctured on the first climb and needed a wheel. Then it cost a lot of energy to get back into the bunch. Damiano Caruso did manage to get away, but the second half of the Mangan was really fast and people were getting spat out the back rather than being able to attack at the front. I saw what happened with Lopez, and I wouldn't be angry with him or with the fan. I came off worse when it happened to me at the Tour last year. It took a long time for my back to get better. But generally, when you do a finish like today's, there are big crowds, some of whom are there from the day before. They're there to support us, but it has to be made safe. It shouldn't be hard to do that on a 6-kilometre climb. I don't want to pass judgment on the organisation of the Giro, because they have a lot to think about. But a lot is asked of us riders as well. Sometimes, perhaps, we'd just like to ask a little more of the organisers.
I mean, second for Nibali, having won the Giro twice, it doesn't do a lot for him. He's 34 now. We questioned at the start of the Giro whether he had another Grand Tour win in him. I think he's exceeded most people's expectations here, if not his own. I suppose the question is, you know, his days at Barry Morita are coming to an end as well. He'll move to Trek Segafredo next year. But at 34, you have to wonder whether this was the last we'll see of Nibali contending in a Grand Tour.
Yeah, he surprised me. He surprised me pleasantly, positively, with how he's ridden in this Giro. He's been aggressive. I don't think he quite has the legs, the power to distance the best guys in the mountains these days. But he's incredibly consistent. He rides smartly. He's a guy who always, well, generally stays upright and moves around the bunch very well, and that counts for a lot. He's, you know, when he goes into a Grand Tour intending to compete for general classification, he generally does it, which, you know, you can't say for too many guys in the peloton at the moment. How many years has he got left? How many shots at the Giro has he got left? Probably not many. Next year, it's going to be intriguing to see him at Trek Segafredo. I think he's going to take his brother with him, Antonio. He'll take a masseur and he'll take his coach, Paolo Slongo. But I don't think Trek Segafredo are going to want to sort of bend completely to Nibali. He's going to have to accommodate them as much as they will have to accommodate him. And you know, he's got a Tour de France as well that he's supposedly going to ride in a few weeks' time. His relationship with the Tour de France is a little bit up and down, isn't it? I mean, he obviously won it in 2014, but he's had some really miserable tour campaigns. And I think he'll go there probably targeting stage wins.
Well, you wonder what he would have done there last year, because he had that crash, of course, on Alpe d'Huez, and he just attacked. And, you know, you do wonder what might have happened at that tour, given what's happened here at the Giro, how in what good shape he's been. What's going on in there, Daniel? There's some excitement. Maybe... Champions League final, of course, tonight, isn't it? And you notice Dave Brailsford was off the race today. Do you know why?
Champions League final.
He's at the Champions League final.
He's playing left midfield for Liverpool, just in front of Andy Robertson.
He is off to the Champions League final. Anyway, you spoke as well to Andy the Engels today at the finish, didn't you?
I did. Primoz Roglic. I thought Roglic was riding a great stage and everything looked under control. And he lost ground, really. He lost his foothold in a quite curious position at the bottom of the descent of the Crocerone. Nibali had tried to attack on the descent, but he only had 4 kilometers to get any kind of gap from Roglic, but he managed to do it just at the sort of at the point where the descent turned to ascent again. Roglic was 200-300 meters behind Nibali, and he never got back on. And that was also the moment at which Superman had his issues with the Slovene. We think it was a Slovenian spectator. That might have affected Roglic as well. But anyway, here's what Adi Engels said at the finish today about Roglic's Giro in general.
He fought until the finish, and this was all he had. And it was, I mean, it was a great fight. Really great to see him. I mean, he was able to keep pushing. He was he didn't collapse. He didn't he didn't went into a crisis or whatever. This was it. He wasn't able. I think the last days really. I mean, yesterday looked promising, but I think also it was for sure the last week when Carapaz, Landa, and Nibali went. I think it showed on the Mortirolo. It showed also Anterselva, for sure Landa, Carapaz a bit, and again today. This was his place in the last week in the mountains.
Adi, it looks like you're going to get third. Would you have taken that at the start of the Giro?
No. That would be a little bit too easy, I guess. But the way how things went, and I think now, I mean, we still have to make up some time. Normally, when he does a good TT, I think it's. I feel confident he would be that he's able to do it. What I said. Looking then to the 3 weeks and at the really decisive moments, not being able to follow Nibali, Carapaz and Landa as well. I think then also that we have to settle for that, and we have to be satisfied as well. With the TTs like this, I think with more support in the mountains, I've said it before, with guys like Gesik and De Plus, I don't say that we would have won. That's for sure difficult to say. But I think we would be longer in the fight. We would be longer close. We wouldn't have the game between Nibali and Primoz, because then he would still have support to chase. We wouldn't have the minutes of Carapaz and Landa. But then maybe there was even a harder walk going on in the end. You never know. But. No, I don't think. I think Primoz, he lost to Carapaz, Landa, Nibali in these climbs. But on the other hand, he was also never really far away. And I mean, the biggest gap was after Mortirolo, and that was because of the 15K slightly up to the finish. But he climbed pretty decent this Giro.
So he'll be off to the Champions League final as well now, won't he, Adi the Engels? He's a doppelganger for Pochettino, the Spurs manager.
Oh, gosh.
He really is. He really is.
Yeah, talk about a dead horse. Anyway, go on.
I don't think I've mentioned that yet, actually. But we expect Roglic, I think, to get back onto the podium tomorrow, don't we?
Absolutely. His time gap to Mikel Landa is, Rich, it is 23 seconds. 23 seconds? No, 13 seconds, according to...
23 with a 10-second penalty.
With a 10-second penalty, correct. What do you make of that, the 10-second penalty? In the rules, it states that... Well,
I think it's harsh. I mean, if somebody's pushing you, putting the burden of responsibility on the rider to stop the rider from pushing you seems a bit much.
But again, you have to think about the precedent. A rider could conceivably mobilize an army of
fans. It's happened, hasn't it? Well, it's happened.
Yeah. So there has to be some kind of punishment.
Yeah. I mean, 10 seconds is really neither here nor there.
For all we know, Rich... they were very good friends of Primoz Roglic's. They went to
his brother.
And they've been talking about this. The kilometer, 2.35 on the Monte Avena, or it was the Crocidana. They were positioned, and they were gonna.
Did it make any difference, really? I mean, he pushed it. It was quite an extended push, admittedly, but would it really have made a difference?
No, but rules are rules, I think. You know.
The Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. They came on board in 2016 to really help us come and cover the Giro for the first time, the full Giro in 2016. We've done it every year since, but... not sure if we'd have been here in 2016 without Science and Sport's support, and they're still with us. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. And if you'd like to be in with a chance of winning a nutrition bundle from Science and Sport and also some Rafa kit, all you have to do is follow the Cycling Podcast on Instagram and share the latest episode in your Instagram story via Spotify. The final winners, one male and one female, will get their hands on a Rafa Pro Team Aero suit, which uses the same technology, race-winning research, as their EF Pro kit. So do that and stand a chance of winning some great prizes. Thank you very much again to Science and Sport. Daniel, you just remarked there when we paused that this is a fantastic setting for the finale before tomorrow's finale of the Giro.
Yeah, well, it's an area with a rich cycling tradition. You know, we know the story of the Crocidana, made famous by Tullio Campagnolo, who effectively invented or came up with the idea for the quick release.
Was it the quick release or the derailleur?
No, the quick release skewer. Because his sort of hands had frozen on the top of the Crocidana and he was struggling to get his wheel off.
I'm asking that because it was one of the questions that our head of marginal gains, Jonathan Rowe, had in his quiz for the Giro.
Yeah.
And I remember it was either quick release or derailleur. And I hummed and hawed over that. And I think I did. I think you're right. His hands were frozen.
No, I'm right.
His hands were frozen, weren't they?
Yeah.
And he couldn't get his wheel off. Yeah. And that was, where that came from. Yeah.
Thanks.
Funny that the quick release has... I've got disc brakes now on my road bike. And so... quick release has become. We need somebody at Campagnolo to become frozen again and invent some kind of quick release for a disc brake wheel.
Indeed. But it is an area with a rich cycling tradition. Tens of thousands, it felt like anyway. Cyclists were on the climb today. We saw them all riding up, riding back down, and. You know, the Giro, the thing about the Giro is that the sort of dimensions, the scale of it is just really perfect for a bike race. It feels like a big event, but not overblown and not too unwieldy. And, I think finishing in Verona tomorrow. It'll be a fantastic spectacle in the arena. All things really that you would love the Tour de France to be able to do, but it's too big, it's too unwieldy.
Daniel, watching Peo Bilbao win his second stage today made me kind of nostalgic for the old Euskaltel-Euskadi team, because he and Mikel Landa, first and second on the stage, were both in that team, as was Mikel Nieve, who was seventh on the stage. And it's funny to see some of these guys have really got on to greater things since that team folded. But there's still this great, rich tradition of cyclists from the Basque Country. But, you know, what that team sort of gifted to the world in terms of that generation of riders is pretty amazing. And I don't know if, you know, Basques, young up-and-coming Basque cyclists will have the same opportunity.
It's interesting. Bilbao now has won two stages in breakaways in this Giro, and he won one in the Dauphiné last year. And he's really developing a clinical streak, which has been less hyped and less commented upon than, for example, Thomas de Gendt's knack of getting into breakaways and converting. But at the moment, you have to say that Peo Bilbao is one of the most dangerous riders in the world when he gets in a break on a hilly course. You know, he's a guy who can push very big gears. Today, he'd been down the road all day, and he was up against Mikel Landa, who had been in the peloton, okay, you know, ridden hard on the Croce d'Auna. But it was pretty impressive to be able to outclimb Landa in that last 500 metres.
Very impressive, and Nibali was definitely up for that stage as well, so... Yeah, he's one of these kind of softly spoken, unassuming riders, as is Nieve, as is Landa. You sometimes wonder whether he's realised his full potential. They're both 29 now, Landa and Peo Bilbao. I spoke at the finish, Daniel, to somebody who's had a very good Giro, Pavel Sivakov. He will finish ninth overall, subject to any decision on Miguel Angel Lopez. And we're seeing now news that he escapes punishment after punching Spectator. Cycling Weekly is reporting that there'll be no punishment for Lopez. So he will remain sixth overall with Sivakov, 21 years old, finishing ninth and second place in the Young Rider competition. He's had a good end to the Giro. Here's what he said at the finish. How did today go then?
Really good for me. Really good. I was really happy how the legs felt. I think my best day, actually, that day 20, so that's really good. I didn't expect. Recovery is going well for me, and it's been great.
Well, you started the Vuelta last year, of course, but didn't finish it, so I guess you didn't know really how you were going to perform into this third week.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't know. Yesterday I wasn't feeling so great, and like I had a few hard days and in the third week, but today it was really good. I mean, in the Paso Mang, and when I was up there with the best guys, so it was really, really something crazy for me.
And you've set to finish top 10. How do you feel about that? You'd have settled for that, I guess, when we started 3 weeks ago.
And to be honest, I didn't really thought that I would finish top 10. I think top 15 was more something I was thinking about, but top 10, you know, it's another step. If you look the time gaps between the top 15 and top 10, it's big. And for me, it's just something crazy, because I didn't thought that I would be here now. Try to move up even, you know, in GC, I had really good legs today. So, yeah, the guys were strong also.
Well, that was Pavel Sivakov. I also asked him, because I saw the great Inner Ring, the blogger, tweeting about his nationality and that he actually holds a French racing license, and yet he competes for Russia. I asked him about that. Here's what he said.
I read today you're taking out a French passport, have you? Or
I've got it already.
You've got it?
Yeah, already for 2 years. Yeah, no.
All
yeah.
Right, so yeah. Will you be competing for France? Is that the plan? Or
nah, I mean, thought about it, especially last year. Like when I got it, really thought about it, but I didn't have didn't find any interest from the French national team. They'd never called me or whatever. And with the Russian national team, I've got much more opportunities. I mean, already last year I could do the Worlds. Maybe I hope to do a Tokyo Olympics in 2020. So, yeah, I mean...
And your families, right? Is it a nice thing for you to represent the country that your family's from?
Yeah, I think that's also good, you know. Even if I almost never go there, I never live there, it's I think it's good to still keep that that thing, you know, that nationality, yeah, that link to the genes, to the blood.
So Sivakov set to carry on racing for Russia. It seems very interesting that the French Federation have apparently shown no interest in Sivakov representing France. And as he says, he thinks he'll get more opportunities riding for Russia. So that's what he will do. I also spoke to his teammate at the finish, also riding his first Grand Tour, Eddie Dunbar. He was in that break today. He's ridden extremely well. He's third on a stage earlier in the Giro, and here's what he had to say at the finish.
You didn't let on this morning, Eddie, that you were going to have such a big day out today.
No, as you said, you just kind of have to go and see how the race is. I think everyone wanted to be in the front today, but that was our plan, get someone ahead of the race, and we did that. I think Pavel more or less secured his top 10 overall, so it's a successful day.
And I mean, you're a young rider, obviously, riding your first Grand Tour, and it's about learning. And there you are on the final mountain stage, you know, with the GC guys as they're kind of fighting out for the race. What was that like for you, you know, to just kind of have that ringside seat?
Yeah, I don't get carried away with it. You know, I just go in, I race my race, and I race my team's race, and I just do what I have to do. I don't really take any notice of who's around me or anything like that. I'm not a fanboy or anything like that. You know, I have huge respect for every one of these riders in the race, and especially the guys who are going for GC. And but when you're in a race, you are competitors, and we have to do our job.
You said you like, you know, you think you've got the capabilities to be a 3-week rider. Do you see yourself developing, or would you like to develop as a GC rider, or you're a kind of punchy rider as well, you can win races too. How would you like to sort of develop?
I think I'm learning a lot about myself this year. I do like the punchier kind of races, but just how my body reacted after this 3 weeks, I'm really happy, and for sure I have a lot to work on, and there's a lot of things I could have done before the Giro to be maybe even a slightly better level again, but that's it. I'm happy with the way everything went, the way I came into it, the way the team rode. Everything is brilliant, and as I said, we came in with a really young team, and we've come out with a top 10, and you can't really ask for more.
Because when did you actually hear you were riding the Giro?
It was the third stage of Yorkshire after that, I think, something like that. So it was a couple of days, short notice, but as I said, when you get an opportunity like that with Team Ineos, you have to grab it with both hands.
Well, Daniel, no punishment for Lopez, but there have been repercussions.
Can we stop this Lopez business?
Sorry.
House style is Superman.
There could be repercussions, however, for somebody else on the Giro. Stacey Snyder, our ceramicist friend, has just tweeted. She listened to last night's podcast, and after your admission that you don't use mugs, she now wonders whether you are, in fact, cup-worthy. And now, interestingly, Orla Shinawi today has got in touch looking for one of these Giro-themed mugs from Stacey Snyder. So let me just read a tweet from a listener, Ted Baxter. Of all the crimes against common decency, did I really hear Freeboss say he uses glass and not ceramic cups for his coffee? Few admissions have chilled me to the bone more than this.
Well, no, this is it's the truth. It's a stone cold truth, Rich. I'm very particular about. My glass, my stemware as well. Always have to have beer in a glass. Always have to see the colour. Basically, always have to admire.
Although there are places where you drink beer or cider out of ceramic mugs,
aren't
there?
I don't drink cider. But one does,
yeah, like in Normandy, you drink
cider. In Asturias in Spain, I think you drink it out of a glass. But yeah, point yes, taken. But
accepted.
No, I'm not big on mugs. I'm sorry.
Well,
I know
Stacey's serious. Her husband, who, as she points out, is married to a ceramic artist. Yeah, thanks for that, Stacey. He also drinks his coffee out of glasses, and so she takes no offence. She would like to point out.
I mean, part of the joy of any drink is the colour.
The colour. So you like a glass in order. Well, okay, well, that's great. Orla, if you're listening, you're going to get Daniel's mug instead of Daniel. And it's nice that it'll go to a good and appreciative home. So that's resolved that. That's good. As we said last night, Stacey's mugs have raised over $2,000 for two good causes, Ride for Charlie and the Kelly Catlin Fund. And it's something we're going to repeat at the Tour de France. She'll do some Tour de France themed mugs, and we'll put them on sale at the start of the tour, and they will also raise money for a different good cause. We'll ask for nominations for that good cause as we get nearer to the tour, although it's not that far away, is it? Now, we're doing a press conference next week, a final kind of wrap-up from the Giro,
If you want to leave us a question for the press conference, leave a voice memo on WhatsApp. That's +44 7971 338 205, +44 7971 338 205. Please get your questions in soon so that we can answer them in the next few days, and that will be out in the middle of the week. While I'm here, we also will be embarking on daily coverage again from the women's tour, which begins a week on Monday. I'll be with Orla Shinawi and Rose Manley. We did it last year, daily coverage from the women's tour, and we're delighted to be able to do that again. I'm really looking forward to that. So I've got a week at home before setting off again on another race, as do you, Daniel. You've got a week's holiday here before you're off to the Dauphiné, aren't
you? Yes, Rich. So I'm going to be spending that week in the Langate Hills near Alba. Tonight, Rich, we're going to be staying in Bassano le Grappa, and we're going to be staying in a hotel named after Ernest Hemingway.
Yes, I noticed
because
that.
Because he spent time, do you know, he spent time in Bassano le Grappa in the First World War. And I think he was an ambulance driver. Yes, he was an ambulance driver on the Italian front. And there is also a Hemingway Museum in Bassano le Grappa, in the villa where he was sent to recuperate after he was wounded by a mortar shell that left shrapnel in both of his legs. And I think his experiences in the First World War were the basis for a book he later wrote, Farewell to Arms, handwritten in 1929. But you're a big fan of Hemingway, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, he volunteered to serve in Italy as an ambulance driver with the American Red Cross. And in June 1918, while running a mobile canteen dispensing chocolate and cigarettes for soldiers, he was wounded by Austrian mortar fire. And A Farewell to Arms is all about a love affair between an American ambulance driver and young English nurse. If you'll recall, Larry Warbass from the same part of the world as Hemingway actually played Hemingway. A few years ago, when we were on the tour of the Basque Country, we got him to read a passage from The Sun Also Rises, which includes a description of the first ever tour of the Basque Country back in 1924, 1925, some time like that. And Larry did a fantastic job.
Well, Rich, Bassano le Grappa, also famous because it's the birthplace of Grappa.
No.
Yes. Grappa, the first ever Grappa distillery was created in Bassano in 1779, the Nardini distillery, which still exists. You're quite partial to a grappa, aren't you? You don't mind a grappa?
Yeah. Yeah, I like a grappa. We've had some very nice grappa. I wasn't aware that there were so many different kind of flavours to grappa. But we've had... Where were we with Lionel when we had a very nice grappa?
In Val d'Aosta.
So, and then tomorrow, Daniel, another literary city, onto Shakespeare's Verona.
Yes. Although...
Are we going to go and see some of the Shakespeare
sites? Well, we could go to...
sites?
We
Romeo
could
and
go
Juliet and
to
all that.
Juliet's, the House of Juliet, famous for in cycling, because Oscar Freire, before he won the 1999 World Championship road race in Verona, and went there with the Spanish team a couple of days before the road race, and he put a Vitalicio Seguros cap on the statue of Juliet, and I think he gave it a kiss on the cheek.
Is it still there to this day?
I'm not sure, but of course Mariah Carey also famously wore a Vitalicio Seguros casquette in the film Butterfly. Am I getting this wrong? Oh, I cannot get
a
piece of
get
trivia
your Hemingway,
regarding
Hemingway facts.
No,
wrong,
but not Mariah Carey, not me.
Oh well, never mind. So we'll be back in Verona tomorrow for the final stage of the Giro. That's all for us from tonight. Thank you, Daniel.
Have I got time to look this up? Mariah Carey, Butterfly. I'm not sure.
Quick.
No, that was her album. That was her album. Glitter, I think the film's called. Oh, no. Glitter, I'm going to say.